Usually when we talk about a diagnostic test, there's this this expectation of total precision.
Right, like an engineering tool.
Yeah, exactly. Like you break your arm, the x-ray shows that jagged white line, and the doctor just points and says, there it is, broken.
It's comforting to have things visible, perfectly categorized.
It really is. But if you step into the world of theoretical physics, specifically the attempt to combine the universe's two most successful theories, suddenly that x-ray machine is, well, it's completely broken.
Oh, totally shattered. The diagnostic landscape is just totally murky.
And that murky landscape is exactly what we are wading into today. We're taking a deep dive into the ultimate headache of modern physics.
The paradox between general relativity and quantum field theory.
Right. And for everyone listening, we're going to explore how evaluating these two massive theories as a kind of sensory detection problem leads to this absolutely mind-bending realization.
Which is that the missing link between quantum mechanics and relativity isn't just about finding some shiny new math equation.
No, it's that we are missing a fundamental theory of how space-time itself is actually measured.
Framing it as a sensory detection problem shifts the entire paradigm, honestly.
Because for decades, right, the approach has just been purely mathematical.
Yeah, just trying to force the equations to play nicely together. But to understand why a new diagnostic approach is even necessary, you have to look at what happens when you smash these two theories together.
Right, so let's break that down for the listener.
Sure. So general relativity is a classical theory. It's all about smooth, continuous space-time geometry.
It tells us gravity is this, like, invisible rope pulling things through space.
Exactly. It's the curving of the space and time fabric itself. But then you have quantum field theory.
The QFT side of things.
Right, which is this framework of fluctuating, vibrating quantum fields that governs the microscopic world. So one is the smooth, continuous canvas, and the other is
like jittery, pixelated paint.
That's a great way to put it, yeah.
And the natural instinct for physicists was just to, well, quantize gravity, treat the metric of space-time, the geometry itself, as a quantum field.
Filled with little vibrating particles called gravitons.
Right. And when you run the math at the most basic level, what physicists call a one-loop calculation, it actually functions.
Which is so frustrating because it feels like this massive false hope.
Because the moment you demand more precision,
right,
you move to a two-loop mathematical calculation, and what happens?
The entire structure collapses. It just explodes into infinities.
The literal infinities in the math.
Yeah, you get divergent mathematical integrals everywhere. Now, in standard quantum theory, when you hit an infinity, you can often handle it using a math process called renormalization.
Which is basically redefining a couple of constants.
Right, exactly. Like the mass or charge of an electron, you base it on experimental data, and boom, the theory recovers its predictive power.
But with quantized gravity,
you get non-renormalizability. To cancel out the infinities at every new loop order, you have to introduce a brand new undetermined constant.
And since you can technically go to infinite loops,
you need an infinite number of constants to fix the math.
Which means the theory isn't predicting anything anymore. It requires infinite experiments just to figure out the parameters.
Exactly. It's useless at that point.
The analogy that comes to mind for me is music. Merging general relativity and QFT is like trying to blend a strictly written classical symphony with a chaotic, rule-breaking, free jazz improvisation.
Oh, I like that.
You try to play them on the same stage at the exact same time, and instead of a cohesive fusion, you just get infinite deafening noise.
Yeah, and to fix the noise, you'd need an infinite number of conductors all shouting entirely different instructions to the orchestra.
Right. And taking that analogy further, the symphony and the jazz band don't contradict each other as standalone art forms.
No, they're beautiful on their own.
They contradict the expectation that they can follow the same sheet music.
Which is where this massive diagnostic shift occurs. Traditional physics looks at that infinite noise and asks, how do we fix the math?
But the new approach from our source material uses something called a formal verification architecture. The 3x3 sensory matrix.
Right. Instead of a binary pass or fail on the math, this AI-driven matrix asks a totally different question. It asks, what pattern of sensory agreement does this theory produce across 9 distinct detection channels?
It's like it sets up a grid to check the universe's vital signs.
Exactly. So the top row, the U row, checks fundamental mathematical constants.
Like pi, the number e, and the imaginary unit I.
Yeah, Then the middle row, the P row, checks physical constants, the fine structure constant alpha, the speed of light C, and Planck's constant H bar.
And H bar is what dictates the quantum scale, right?
Spot on. Then we get to the bottom row, the M row, which evaluates complex thermodynamic values.
Like the Riemann zero and this thing called the Bekenstein-Hawking one-quarter factor.
We should definitely unpack that one-quarter factor.
Yeah, for you listening, it sounds incredibly abstract, but it's crucial to why gravity and quantum mechanics clash.
It is. So the Bekenstein-Hawking one-quarter factor is a cornerstone of black hole thermodynamics.
Okay.
It states that the entropy of a black hole, the measure of its hidden information or disorder, is precisely equal to one quarter of the area of its event horizon.
So it links thermodynamics, which is heat and disorder, directly to geometry, the actual physical surface area.
Exactly. It's profound. Mm. And when we run general relativity through the 3x3 sensory matrix, it perfectly passes this one quarter cell at the bottom.
Because classical gravity natively predicts black hole entropy.
Right. However, general relativity completely fails the H-bar cell in the middle row.
Because classical spacetime has no built-in quantum scale. It doesn't know what H-bar is.
Exactly. And quantum field theory does the exact opposite.
It breezes through the H-bar cell perfectly because, well, it's the language of the quantum scale.
But it entirely fails the one-quarter cell. It just cannot derive that thermodynamic connection to geometry from its first principles.
Yeah.
So the matrix basically isolates the failure to a very specific cross-section.
It does. It doesn't solve the math for us. It acts like a theory mechanic pointing under the hood of the universe and highlighting the exact fault line.
The problem lies precisely between the quantum scale and gravity's thermodynamic scale.
The matrix calls this a cross-cell resonance failure.
Meaning these two theories are literally failing to sense the same reality in the exact same spot.
Yes. And because the matrix isolates this conflict so perfectly, we're forced to look at how these two domains fundamentally perceive reality.
Because they're speaking entirely different mathematical languages at a foundational level.
Absolutely. Think about general relativity. It deals strictly with real numbers.
Right. Like when you measure astronomical distances, planetary masses, the curvature of space-time.
The metric of space-time is always a real, definite, concrete value. Always.
But quantum field theory
relies fundamentally on complex numbers. It heavily utilizes the imaginary unit.
Which is wild, because in quantum mechanics, before you observe a particle, it exists in a complex superposition of multiple states.
Right. These states are described by probabilities that literally require imaginary numbers.
You absolutely need I for quantum interference to function.
Yeah, for those probability waves to peak and trough and interact with one another.
But here's the disconnect, and this is where I think it gets really fascinating. If QFT is swimming in imaginary numbers, we still get real concrete results when we actually run a quantum experiment.
Exactly. The readout on a computer screen in a lab is a real number, not an imaginary one.
So how does it make that jump?
That transition is governed by measurement. To extract a real number out of quantum field theory, a measurement must occur.
Measurement is the physical process that collapses that blurry, complex superposition into a single definite outcome.
Yes. The math operation of squaring the amplitude removes the imaginary component, leaving you with classical reality. Measurement is the bridge between the imaginary quantum world and the real physical world.
Wait, I'm struggling with this implication a bit.
Okay, what part?
Well, if general relativity doesn't have a measurement postulate, if it just assumes the universe is always classical and real, how have we been successfully using it for a century?
To predict black holes and guide GPS satellites and all that.
Yeah. Why does it suddenly need to snap into reality now just because we're trying to combine it with quantum mechanics?
Okay. So general relativity functions flawlessly as an effective classical theory because it operates after the universe has already chosen a definitive state.
Okay.
For GPS satellites, the Earth's mass and the curvature of space-time are already concrete. They're already measured, so to speak.
But when you try to trace the universe back to its fundamental roots,
quantum field theory demands that at the microscopic level, the gravitational field itself must be in a complex superposition of different geometries.
Space and time must be blurry.
Yes. And general relativity has no mechanism to handle a blurry geometry.
And more importantly, it has no rule for how a blurry geometry becomes a concrete one. Which means the paradox isn't just about math loops and infinities. We are literally missing the fundamental rule for how a superposed quantum universe measures itself.
We have no mathematical measurement apparatus for gravity.
Like, how do you even superpose two different shapes of space-time? And what physical mechanism forces space-time to collapse into the single geometry we experience every day?
And this realization is where the diagnosis becomes a blueprint for a cure.
Right, because if the problem is a missing measurement theory for space-time, we have to engineer what that physical law looks like.
Which brings us to the sources framework. Conditional collapse theory, or CCT?
CCT.
Okay. Rather than treating the transition from quantum to classical as this magical instantaneous event, CCT models it as a dynamical process.
Specifically, it uses an ordinary differential equation, an ODE.
Yeah.
And let's ground the concept of an ODE for you listening, because ordinary differential equation sounds like a wall of textbook jargon.
It really does.
Modeling measurement as an ODE fundamentally changes how we view reality.
Hmm.
Instead of measurement being a discrete, instantaneous jump like flipping a light switch on,
right,
an ODE calculates continuous change over a period of time. It's like tracking the velocity of a flowing river.
That's a perfect analogy. It makes the collapse of superposition a mechanical, fluid process occurring over a specific duration.
So how does CCT actually use this equation?
By using an ODE, we break the measurement problem into two distinct components, the stationary backbone and the probability component.
Okay, what's the stationary backbone?
It consists of the absolute guardrails of physics that we know cannot be violated.
Like general covariance.
Right. The principle that the laws of physics are the same for all observers, and that Bekenstein-Hawking entropy we discussed earlier.
So any new theory of measurement has to fit inside that rigid skeleton.
Exactly. And the probability component contains the unknowns we're trying to solve for.
The two biggest unknowns being the collapse operator and the collapse rate.
Yes. Meaning, what specific feature of space-time is actually triggering this fluid flowing measurement process?
And how fast does that blurry superposition snap into classical reality?
Precisely. And when conditional collapse theory navigates through all the possibilities to find a model that fits within those guardrails, it proposes something called a continuous stochastic area-driven collapse.
Which is a mouthful.
Yeah.
But the analogy I want to use here is a camera autofocusing.
Oh, I love the autofocus analogy.
Right. Space-time starts as a blurry superposition of different geometries, but the universe is constantly running this ODE process, mechanically adjusting the lens over a specific amount of time until it resolves into a sharp classical image.
It captures the continuous nature perfectly, and conditional collapse theory identifies exactly what the lens is focusing on.
It calls this target the pointer basis.
Right. In this framework, reality chooses to collapse into eigenstates of the volume operator.
More specifically, the square root of the volume operator. But wait, the volume operator. Why does the actual physical volume of space dictate how the universe measures itself?
Okay, so in quantum mechanics, systems decohere or lose their quantum blurriness when they interact with their environment.
Right.
In the CCT framework, superpositions of different space-time geometries face a decoherence rate that is proportional to the difference in their physical volumes.
So the larger the volume difference between the superposed states,
the faster the differential equation drives the system out of a quantum state and into a single classical reality.
Volume is the trigger.
Volume is the trigger.
That is wild. But a theory is only as useful as its testability.
Always.
If space-time is a camera constantly autofocusing based on physical volume, we need to know the shutter speed.
We do.
If this is a flowing mechanical process, how fast does it happen? And how can we actually prove it in a laboratory without just, you know, relying on elegant math?
Well, the model requires a brand new fundamental constant of nature to govern the shutter speed. It's denoted by the Greek letter tau, representing the collapse timescale. And the mathematics suggests that tau is proportional to the Planck time.
The Planck time, which is absurdly brief. For context, it is roughly 5.39 times 10 to the negative 44 seconds.
Yeah.
You were talking about 0 point, followed by 43 zeros, and then a 5.
It is literally the smallest meaningful tick of the clock in physics.
But the critical mechanic of the theory is how this time scale interacts with physical volume, right?
Exactly. The collapse rate scales directly with the linear size of the system.
Okay, so microscopic superpositions, like a single electron moving through a laboratory,
they have an infinitesimally small volume.
Therefore, the volume difference between their superposed states is virtually non-existent.
Yes. So the autofocus equation runs incredibly slowly for them.
Which perfectly explains why microscopic particles can survive in a blurry quantum superposition for a very long time.
Exactly. It's why quantum mechanics works so flawlessly for small things. The environment isn't forcing them to choose a shape quickly.
But macroscopic superpositions face a completely different reality.
Very different.
Consider a baseball or a black hole or even like the couch in your living room.
Right.
Their sheer physical volume forces the equation to run at maximum speed.
Yeah. This is why you, the listener, never walk into your living room and see your couch in a superposition of two different locations.
Right. It's not that quantum mechanics magically stops working at the threshold of your front door.
No, it's that the couch's massive volume forces space-time to continuously measure it.
The universe is aggressively auto-focusing your couch into a single reality so fast you could never possibly catch it being blurry.
It collapses in a fraction of a nanosecond. And that aggressive autofocusing perfectly reproduces the classical limit of general relativity.
So the missing link between QFT and GR is simply the universe acting as its own observer, using physical volume to force geometry into reality.
That's the core of it.
Okay, but I have to challenge the physics of this continuous measurement process.
Bring it on.
If space-time is constantly undergoing this stochastic collapse, if reality is continuously crunching the math to autofocus the couch, the planet, the entire cosmos, does this process require energy? Because if measurement is a mechanical, non-reversible action happening constantly, does the sheer friction of the universe observing itself cause reality to heat up?
It's a brilliant question, and the mathematics of conditional collapse theory confirm exactly that.
Wait, really?
Yes. The model predicts a tiny but persistent violation of standard quantum unitarity.
Okay.
Because the collapse of space-time geometry is a physical, non-reversible process governed by an ODE, it creates a microscopic back reaction.
Meaning?
It literally causes spontaneous heating across the universe. Energy is injected into the system simply by the act of maintaining a classical reality.
The universe heats up just by trying to keep its story straight. That is incredible.
It is. And that tiny deviation, that spontaneous heating, gives us a tangible way to test a theory of quantum gravity.
Right. Because how do we build an X-ray machine to catch the universe in the act of measuring itself?
The theory points toward next-generation massive interferometers.
Okay, tell me about those.
So current quantum experiments usually involve incredibly tiny masses, like atoms or molecules.
Right.
But if you take a tiny yet macroscopic mass, say 10 to the negative 14 kilograms, and manage to place it into a quantum superposition in a supercooled, highly isolated laboratory vacuum.
Let me just pause you. A mass of 10 to the negative 14 kilograms is essentially a heavy speck of dust.
Right. Massive compared to an electron, but invisible to the naked eye.
Okay, so you put this dust speck into a superposition.
Standard quantum theory predicts it should remain in that state as long as it's perfectly isolated from its environment.
But conditional collapse theory predicts something else.
It predicts that due to volume-induced decoherence, it will spontaneously collapse out of superposition at a rate of roughly 10 to the negative 5 seconds.
The geometry of the dust speck will force space-time to measure it.
Yes. And if we run that experiment and observe the superposition vanish precisely when the volume mathematics dictate it should, independent of any environmental interference, we have verified the measurement theory of space-time.
We would have physical proof that volume forces reality to become classical.
Exactly.
Wow.
Ah.
Let's synthesize what this all means for our understanding of the cosmos, because we've covered a ton of ground.
We really have.
For decades, the deepest paradox in physics was viewed as this insurmountable mathematical wall, combining the smooth, classical curves of general relativity with the jittery, probabilistic quantum fields of QFT just resulted in infinite noise.
And we just assumed the math was broken.
But by running the problem through the 3x3 sensory matrix, the diagnosis shifted.
We mapped the sensory footprints of both theories and found the exact fault line.
Right. The quantum world requires a measurement event to transition from imaginary probabilities to real outcomes.
And the gravitational world, governing space-time itself, lacked any mechanism to perform that measurement.
So through conditional collapse theory, we found a map of what that missing physics must look like.
A continuous area-driven collapse.
It's a reality where physical volume actively forces the quantum blur to snap into the classical world. Space-time is constantly measuring itself.
It really fundamentally shifts our relationship with the cosmos.
Yeah, because we aren't just passively existing in a classical universe. The universe is actively working, constantly running differential equations to remain classical.
The environment isn't just a backdrop where physics happens. The physical scale of the environment is the mechanism that enforces reality.
Which leaves us with a final, deeply provocative concept to ponder. And this was buried in the deeper layers of the framework we analyzed today.
Oh, that's my favorite part.
In the purest equations of quantum gravity, time doesn't actually exist. The mathematics portray the universe as a static block.
Right.
But if this continuous, non-reversible collapse of space-time geometry is happening everywhere, all the time, constantly forcing the quantum blur into a sharp classical present, could this be the physical clock that solves the problem of time in physics?
I mean, if the autofocusing of reality is a physical process that moves in one direction, from a superposed probability to a definite classical state,
and generates a tiny amount of heat in the process,
it creates an irreversible sequence of events.
Exactly. Does the very act of space-time measuring itself literally create the arrow of time as we experience it?
It's a staggering thought.
Is the forward march of time, the ticking of the clock, simply the sound of reality constantly measuring its own volume to stay in focus?
If that process is the true engine of reality, then time is not a dimension we're passively moving through.
Time is the scar left behind by the universe observing itself.
Wow.
Think about that mechanism the next time you look at the second hand on your watch. The universe is actively drawing the jagged white lines of reality, frame by frame, volume by volume, Planck second by Planck second.
It's beautiful, really.
It truly is. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the reality around you, and we'll catch you next time.